People, Wisconsin U.S. Senate Republican primary candidate forum is made possible in part by the Wisconsin Education Association Council, working to make every school a great school so that every child leaves school prepared for life and the jobs of the future. Great schools benefit you. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Wisconsin, Wisconsin's healthcare partner. American Family Insurance, all your protection under one roof. Madison Gas and Electric Company, working to meet the growing needs of our community through a mix of resources, while helping customers protect the environment through conservation. It's the We the People U.S. Senate Republican Primary Candidate Forum. And now, live from Madison, here's Wisconsin Public Television's Frederica Freiberg.
Welcome to tonight's Senate Primary Candidate Forum. Now, notice that I didn't say debate. That is not what is happening in the next hour, at least in the traditional sense. There are no opening or closing statements, no stopwatches, rebuttals, or podiums. Tonight, the four candidates running in the Republican primary for U.S. Senate will discuss amongst themselves three issues of importance to Wisconsinites. Now, the topics came to us from a statewide We the People poll, where respondents rated health care costs, job creation, and the war in Iraq as top issues facing our state and country. We'll divide the hour ahead into roughly those three topics, three unmoderated conversations among the candidates. Let's meet them now. Attorney Robert Gerald Lorge, car dealership owner Russ Darrow, State Senator Bob Welch, and construction company owner Tim Michaels. We begin our forum by asking the candidates to discuss their approach to controlling health care costs. So for the next quarter hour or so, that topic is on the table. And we are so determined to allow the candidates to talk among themselves that we don't even have a coin toss to determine who will speak first. So this is the part where I go over and sit with the rest of the audience, and I will be back in 15 minutes to move the group on to our next issue. But again, the topic on the table is health care costs and coverage, and the floor is yours.
Well, I think Frederica didn't have to take a poll for us to know that health care is going to be such an important issue, not only throughout this election cycle, but for the next 6 years to come. I know the year that I've been out on the campaign trail, it's been a huge issue. It comes up, if not first, it comes up second or third, all of the time. And it's an issue that I've lived sitting in that corner office at our construction business, where you're responsible for health care for your employees. And we have about 2,000 employees at our company, and about 80% of them are union, so they have great health care. And the non-union employees, we have great health care for them as well. But we do have a big problem here, because 2 years ago, our health care costs went up 42%. Last year, our health care costs went up another 17%, and we're looking at them going up another 15% this year. So our health care costs have nearly doubled in the last few years, cumulatively. Small business owners, farmers, people all over Wisconsin are in the exact same boat. We have to do something about this issue. I have a two-part answer, and I know that all of us agree that we should not go to the first part of that answer, where Russ Feingold wants to go and Hillary Clinton. That's government-run, socialized health care. I want to move in the other direction, more privatization, bring more competition into the medical marketplace. And there's two great tools that are out there right now. There's associated health plans and health savings accounts. Health savings accounts, of course, are tax-free, portable accounts, which will bring more competition into the medical marketplace. And I think these are two wonderful first steps in the right direction.
I agree. As I've gone through the state, you know, in the last couple of weeks and last 7 or 8 weeks, and meeting the people on Main Street, we've absolutely asked that question. And it's unbelievable how businesses that are 1 to 20 people, maybe even 1 to 10 people, supposed to be the backbone of our state and backbone of our country, small businesses. And it's just amazing how we don't have health care. These people that are in business and risking, they've got the risk of failure and the rewards of success if they can do it, and they just don't have health care. We've got to do something about it. And of course, I agree that we certainly can't do the federal issue that Russ Feingold is saying. And that, to me, is the most important part, because we just have to have a private way. And of course, the way that I see it is to have larger medical savings accounts where it's like a debit card, where you get money taken out by the employer, and it stays with you for life. You can take it interstate. You own it for life, and you can invest it in some federally authorized accounts, so you can grow with the economy. Then we need the associated health plan that you were talking about, where when we allow small groups to pool their resources and increase their purchasing power, that can be groups of downtown associations or chambers of commerce or groups of realtors or grocers or any kind of business, and it can be 10, 15, 20,000 groups of farmers. And just today I talked to somebody about farming. They should do that like co-op. And when you do that, they can get much better choices, better pricing, and they can get them at discounted prices like the big corporations. And the last thing, of course, is tort reform. We've got to have tort reform to absolutely stop the frivolous lawsuits that are driving up the cost in our health industry.
We all know the problem. I mean, this is clearly one of the top issues that we've all talked about. Unfortunately, we're running against a guy who has a very simple answer. And I've been in politics 20 years. I know simple answers tend to win. So we got to make sure we have an answer that works, too. Because it's simple to say, let's just have the federal government take it over. Although Russ Feingold doesn't even want to pay for his plan. He wants to force it on the states as an unfunded mandate. You guys figure it out. I'm not going to even write a plan. I'm going to make the states come up with one. But we need to have a plan. And I have a plan. The most comprehensive health care reform plan of anybody running out there that I've seen in any of the states. It's on my website, votewelch.com. And it's a 24-point plan that talks about health savings accounts. Absolutely. That's the key to bringing the market back into the health care, so price again matters. It talks about association health plans. Absolutely. Let small businesses like I ran group together so you can get some market power when you're out there trying to buy insurance. But also, not just tort reform, but going beyond tort reform to say we've got to change the whole legal system. You know, we've had these little inches of tort reform caps and so on. We've got to change that legal system so it stops being a lottery. It's got to be there to protect the innocent, to punish the guilty, but it doesn't need to be a lottery where people get rich quick. And lastly, transparency in pricing. You know, this is such a sad thing that people will come up to me and say, gee, I couldn't afford to buy a meal because, you know, I had to pay for my prescription drug. And they didn't even bother to shop around. And various pharmacies are much different in their pricing because nobody asks how much things cost, because some amorphous third party tends to be paying most of the time. We got to get back to transparency. The pricing in the pharmacy should be listed down the side of the wall. When you ask a doctor how much it costs, they shouldn't look at you like you're from Mars. They should know how much everything costs. The hospital should be competing based on price. We've lost that in this system. When I was a kid, we had that. And for the last 20 years in the legislature, we've been fighting to move in that direction slowly. But we need it. We need to move fast because we've reached crisis level and people aren't getting health insurance. People are going without. I just talked yesterday, a pharmacist who's in the health insurance or in the health providing business can't afford health insurance for himself and his employees. That's a crime in this country. We can do it, and we don't need to have the government do it for us.
Well, you know, there are a lot of nurses that can't even afford health care, and they're the ones that we're relying on to provide health care for the rest of us. I don't see any problem with keeping medical savings accounts and expanding them, but usually you have to be fairly wealthy or at least be able to save some money to put into those type of accounts. Associated health plans are great, too, but, you know, they cherry pick, and after a while, with cherry picking, a lot of people fall out of the system and they join the 43 to 45 million people who are totally uninsured. Now, it's a fact that the insurance companies out there, they're not earning one penny of premium on the 43 to 45 million people who are uninsured. They can provide the best health care in the United States, the private system. I think we all agree that Feingold basically came up with the socialized medicine just because he's running for re-election. You know, for the 12 years that he was there and held these listening sessions, 11 out of those 12 years, healthcare was the number one issue, except in 87 when it was campaign finance reform. So what did he do? He dropped everything to do this goofy McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform and did nothing about healthcare, except for when he announced he was running for re-election. I have a plan to get everybody into the private system, and that's to create group plans by putting everybody into a demographically blind pool and letting private insurance companies bid on it so that you get the lowest possible premium, because I believe competition works and works really well in America. So that would be the accessibility part of it. The affordability part of it, make it 100% tax deductible with tax credits for the poor so that we get everybody into the system.
Well, we're talking about lowering the cost of health care. And the Small Business Health Fairness Act, which was evaluated by the Government Accounting Office, they estimated that health care costs would go down from 15% to 30%. So we know that, and in that Fairness Act, our associated health plans, our health savings accounts. So even the GAO says that it's a step in the right direction, although it's President Bush's plan. So that's one way to get health care costs down. You know, Bob was talking a little bit about prescription drugs. I'm the only one here that's really talking about changing the law to allow for the safe and legal reimportation of prescription drugs from Canada. And I don't look at this as a partisan issue. I look at it as an American issue. You know, when you're sitting at home and you have to make a decision, should I buy groceries or should I buy my medicine? You know, that hits you hard. And there's a couple of great Republicans that are with me on this issue. Paul Ryan is, Jim Sensenbrenner, Trent Lott. It's not a partisan issue. It's an American issue. And it's a great first step in the right direction towards getting the pharmaceutical companies to lower their prices, because right now Americans are shouldering the burden for the high cost of prescription drugs, and I don't think that's right. But you know, Senator Feingold, he says he's going to implement a plan where he's going to force somebody else to come up with a reason to fix this health care. Typical Russ Feingold, passing the buck. That's his idea of leadership. I'm going to make somebody else do it. Leadership is about making tough decisions in tough times. Right. Russ Feingold hasn't done that. He hasn't done that on the Patriot Act. He hasn't done that on health care. The list goes on. It's time for leadership for the people of Wisconsin. And that's exactly what I want to do.
I disagree a little bit on this prescription drug thing. I side with Tommy Thompson. He says we can't allow drugs to be coming in over the internet and from mail order from Canada.
Absolutely.
When we don't know where they're really coming from. There's been a lot of studies showing a lot of these drugs are coming from Malaysia. They're coming from little islands out in the middle of the Pacific. We don't know where they're coming from. And so we can't afford to have our seniors and our non-seniors buying drugs over the internet, coming in, and they're not the right color pill. They're not the right pill that could kill people.
And this is a real issue, Bob, that...
Let me finish, Bob.
It's fine to let them come in from Canada because they've been approved. It's all these other third world countries where they're unsafe.
Right, and we don't know which is which. Now, here's the ultimate answer. You know, fine, if you want to drive to Toronto and buy a drug in a pharmacy there, I'm not going to stop you. But the ultimate answer is you should be able to drive to your local drugstore, the local Walgreens, the local Family Mart owned by your local pharmacist, walk in, look them in the eye, talk about the prescription, know what it's going to do, and then buy it for the same price you can get it in Toronto. That's what we got to have.
Well, we got to look at the delivery system, too.
Exactly.
I mean, I truly want to get in it. I'm not against the idea of reimportation from Canada or something like that, but to me, it's a second or third alternative. I think the first thing is to get the drug companies together in Washington and give them 60 or 90 days to come back with a plan on how they're going to stop discriminating against Americans. People in a first world country like ours should not be paying more than people in Europe or people in Canada or other first world countries. These are American companies that are charging us too much, and I resent that a lot. And as a senator, I'd use my business background and get a coalition of senators and congressmen to get right in their face on it, because that is not right to do. I mean, the numbers are out there. There are a lot of shareholders, people that really, you know, cook their look at and analyze their earnings reports, their annual reports, and they don't need to have the kind of markup that they're having on this. We need a delivery system. For example, when they sell to their wholesalers, they have X pricing. Then the wholesalers are selling to retailers. But we already know, and I checked this out before coming here, of course, in this campaign, that other parts of the country, by region, are being charged more for the price of the same drugs. So now you're talking about the regional marking up, and then you get to the ultimate retailing. And of course, part of our whole idea of the free enterprise system is your buying power and how you can retail and have a fair profit. But if you look at Walmarts, and then you look at Walgreens, and then you look at small pharmacies, there's a big difference in the pricing right there. I mean, that's a big deal, and we've got to look.
Price. The federal government can lead by saying we're going to pay no more than the same price you're charging in Canada. That's it. You charge Canada whatever you want then. If you got to make a profit, you got to cover your research costs, you need to do that, because I want the life-saving drugs to continue to be developed. It saves lives. But why should the Americans provide all of the cost for research and development? Why should we burden?
It's not just a question of having the federal government doing it. It's a question of enforcing our current laws. We have antitrust price-fixing laws on the books now. These drug companies are ripping us off. Part of the problem is nobody in Washington, D.C. wants to do anything about it. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that there are a lot of politicians out there that take a lot of money from these lobbyists, from the big drug companies, and that's why they're very slow to act to protect the American consumer. We need a change in Washington, D.C. We need a change in leadership, people who will stand up for the people and make sure that the laws that we have on the books are enforced against price fixing and monopoly practices.
I agree with that.
And that's exactly what
I'm not going to be beholden to any big corporations in Washington, D.C. But, Russ, I do disagree with I don't think you're going to be able to just bring the pharmaceutical companies into your office and sit them down and say, hey, guys, let's start doing it different. You've got to use the free market system.
I want to bring it to Washington in front of a panel.
But, you know, we've got to use the free market system. That's what works. That's what made America great. And by allowing for the safe and legal reimportation of prescription drugs from Canada, that will be a great step. And it will force the pharmaceuticals to say, we can't have three tiers of pricing and have America be the only country at the top of that pricing tier. We've got to break down that barrier, that wall where countries like Canada and Brazil and Germany aren't paying their fair share. I think that's how we get there with the free market system.
Unless we have the implementation finally of COOL, country of origin labeling. It was passed by Congress, but then the implementation language, when it came around, was somehow lost and tabled. Congress decided not to act on it. Things like country of origin labeling would help us not just in...
My kids do that. Only with milk.
Sorry about that.
It wouldn't just help us in the drug area. It would also help us basically have stopped this mad cow disease that came in from Alberta. I believe in made in America products.
Part of our plan
people
is
ought to know what they're buying.
Complete transparency. So I don't... if you can make something safe in France, we'll take it. If you can make it safe in Malaysia, which I don't think you can, but you got to prove it safe. That's fine. But bottom line is, why should the uninsured person in this country pay the most for health care? They pay the most because they don't have someone negotiating a lower price for them. I think the price should be the same for everybody. Price of an appendix operation, same for everybody. Price of Lipitor, same for everybody. Because it is ridiculous. We've allowed this system to build up because some people can go in and negotiate a lower price, and some people don't have that buying power, small business, and that is leading directly to uninsured people.
But we
should
be one price. We have to be very careful.
Not set by the government.
No,
set by the market.
Right, and the entitlement issue, because you got to know it. I mean, people that don't have health insurance today, a lot of them are saying, "Hey, look, the government owes it to us, and we're entitled to it." And that isn't really the way it is. What I'd like to be sure to do is to analyze the 45 or 43 million people that they say are uninsured today, and let's look at how many of them earn over $50,000 a year, and they've just decided not to. I've got a lot of employees in my company that, on their own, even though our company shares on a very, very generous basis with our employees and offer different kinds of alternatives for insurance, and many of them just decide not to. They'd rather buy a car and have higher car payments or a house payment.
And you get a dual-income household where you don't need double health insurance. The husband or the wife can bring health care to the household.
But what bothers me about what you were saying before is the idea that as a U.S. senator or a congressman, there's an absolute obligation to guarantee safety of what's coming in. We've touched on a little bit, but I'm bothered by the fact that our country, as sophisticated as we are, cannot stop importation of fake Rolexes, fake Nike and Reebok materials and shirts. And people go into stores today and buy hats and shirts, and where are they made? Bangladesh or wherever they are. But we can't stop the phony importation where it's not disclosed to the country of origin,
is even what happened with the bovine, with the mad cow disease that came from Alberta and infected some cattle out in Montana and that part of the world. And we had recalls of beef right here in Wisconsin as a result of it. And that's got to end. You know, when you look at how global the economy is, and that's another subject we ought to touch on, because there are pros and cons with it, we're going to have more of this unless we actually lock down the borders in such a way and control what comes in. Right now, only 4% of the goods that come into the United States are even inspected. We don't know what's sitting in the warehouse. We don't know the quality of the products. We don't know who really made them. All we know sometimes is who stuck a label on it. The label might have been stuck on in New York or someplace, made in America, when the whole product might have been made in Malaysia or Singapore or someplace else. There's no quality control anymore.
Before we drift too far off of healthcare, though, there's a lot of people, including people in the upper levels in Washington, that say that we can provide for the safe reimportation of prescription drugs. The technology is out there. So I don't think that the fear of, hey, we're going to have all these knockoff drugs coming in, is worth the balance of people not being able to afford prescription drugs, or somebody that really needs a drug to keep themselves healthy, has to pay 3 or 4 or 5 times what they're paying right across the border in Canada.
Got the task force going. I'll leave it to his judgment.
Yeah, he's one of the guys that thinks that we may
be able to.
It's
time to break this up now. It's all going great except throwing water at one another.
That wasn't on purpose.
I know. Well, it is time to move on to our next discussion topic. But before we do, we want to let you know that audience members will have a chance to ask candidate follow-up questions toward the end of the program. And so even as we prepare to forge ahead with more candidate conversation, we'd like for those of you who have scribbled down a question to pass those on to the floor assistants you see making the rounds. We will do another collection after a little while. Meanwhile, on to the topic of job creation. candidates. You have the next quarter hour or so to discuss your plans for how to save jobs and put more people to work in Wisconsin.
This is the number one issue. This is by far the number one issue. Quality jobs. We are slipping in Wisconsin. We do not have the same kind of quality jobs we used to have. We've lost a lot of our manufacturing base. People are, a year ago, were desperate, now are concerned. They're concerned about the future. They've seen their neighborhood factory close down. They want to know what's going to happen. And there's a three-part answer. First part is taxes and regulation. We have basically made ourselves less competitive. We have the second highest taxes of any country in the world. And that's like putting a tariff on ourselves. It's stupid policy. In the Irish Republic, they reduced their taxes from one of the highest in the EU to the lowest, and they have the fastest growing economy in Europe as a result. And that's been in place now for 8 years. So we know it works. We had to lower our taxes on exported goods. I got a plan called the Smart Plan, Save Money and Reduce Taxes, which does that. Regulation. We forced the steel industry overseas. When the steel industry left, and the tool and die maker started to go, and the metal bender started to go, and the pots and pans maker started to go, we're losing our industrial base because we can't site a steel plant. We can't site an oil refinery. In Wisconsin, we couldn't build a new paper machine. Number one paper state in the country. Our regulations tied people up for years. We need the same environmental standards we have today, but we need to make sure that we can get them done in 3 months instead of 3 years or 6 years.
Since I came in the business guy, and since I got into this market, I've been saying to myself, where was Russ Feingold while all this was going on? Because when we were losing 78,900 jobs between 2001 and 2003, manufacturing jobs, about half those jobs are going to other states. They didn't go overseas, and they weren't export jobs or outsourced jobs or whatever we want to call them today. So you got an issue here where I would propose that I'd get real involved from the federal level because you put together the local and state elected officials together with the heads of companies, together with a representative of the federal government that's actively involved, and you're going to get different answers because every one of these people that want to do joint ventures with foreign companies or they want to move to another state because another state's trying to out-incentivize Wisconsin or because our government might not be listening here on a state level, guess what? They all want some kind of federal help. They all want some incentives. And I'll tell you what, I think there's an absolute obligation on the part of the federal government to sit in on those meetings and say, what are we doing about creating jobs? And that'll stop the loss of jobs because it'll give encouragement to the leaders of the companies that are here in the country, in this state. We need more jobs for our research park, for example, right in Madison and maybe in Milwaukee. And these are high-paying jobs. It's very important that we do that. We have to increase employment, and that'll stop the loss. And we also help the economy grow.
Every time we outsource a job to a place like Communist China or some sweatshop nation, if a person's lucky enough to get another job, nationally, they're taking a 21% pay cut. In Wisconsin, we're lucky because it's only 18.5%. But if you do that, you know, four times in a row from the average income, you're underwater. You're under the minimum wage. And it's pure slave labor over there. You know, we fought the Civil War 150 years ago to end slave labor. I'm not a free trader because when I hear free trade, I hear a gimmick with the language. It's slave trade. It's not fair trade, and that's what we need. A lot of these treaties that basically Congress, you know, the House of Representatives and the Senate and the President allowed to get passed, whether it was Fast Track or the WTO or NAFTA, they have not done well for the United States. I do not buy into the myth that we are gaining jobs, or at least the jobs that we are gaining are not as high quality as the jobs that are leaving. And I don't blame the corporations. I don't call them renegade corporations. I agree with Bob on this, unlike John Kerry, you know, who calls them renegade corporations and would like to punish them. They're going because they've got competitive pressures, as we all know. They've got to be competitive with their competitors. And nobody can compete with slave labor. I think we need 10% tariffs just on that ground alone, because there's no end to the race of the bottom in this country. That's a race we do not want to win.
I think you can have free trade and fair trade. You can have free trade and not have fair trade, which is what we have right now, but you can't have fair trade and not free trade. So you have to level the playing field. You have to break down the barriers that there are. And you know, let's take a country like China right now. They're cheating on a grand scale. They're manipulating their currency. You know, they're using it as a commodity, and right now the yuan is undervalued by 40%. They're not honoring our intellectual property laws, and they're not honoring our patent rights. The only incentive that we could possibly give them to change is to go so far as to threaten them with revoking their PNTR, their permanent normalized trade relations. And that's exactly what I will do. And I'm the only one that's talking about being really tough on a country like China here, because we have to level the playing field. We talked about the manufacturing jobs leaving the state. The only way you're going to get the manufacturing jobs to stop leaving the state is if we take away that incentive that there is to move those jobs overseas. And that should be duty number one of a U.S. senator here in Wisconsin.
We will beat the thing on China, but we will not do it with temporary tariffs. You can never win against slave labor. That is not enough. You have to end it. The only thing propping up the Chinese government right now are these multinational corporations that are doing the outsourcing. That is a moral question as well as an economic question. We have to hit it head on that way. But then we also have to do what Bob was talking about, and that's cutting our taxes. Right now, the Europeans, their overall business tax rate's about half of what ours is. Same demographic labor group. If you were wanting to do some competition and win in the competitive world that we are, what would you do? Wouldn't you be tempted to move to, say, Canada or Europe?
And this is something that we need someone who can go to Washington to get it done. I've cut taxes. I'm the author of the property tax freeze here. I fought Governor Doyle on it. I fought Governor Doyle on the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. We didn't quite get that through. I passed the Job Creation Act with a lot of help from a lot of other people. I passed the Small Business Regulatory Bill of Rights to give small business a chance to veto unnecessary regulations. We've been doing it here in Wisconsin, trying to make ourselves more competitive. We need someone in the U.S. Senate who has that same experience and that effectiveness. It's fine to go out there and say, I want to do this, but you got to have the skills to get it done.
I agree with you 100%.
I've been able to do that. And one last thing, and I'll let you go. We need a senator who's going to fight for Wisconsin. You know, we've been talking about national issues. It's a wonderful thing. We're all going to get a chance to vote on that. But who's fighting for Wisconsin right now? I'm 46 years old. We've never had a senator, either party, who made Wisconsin their number one priority. I want to go to Washington, and I'm going to fight for Wisconsin. And if a policy may hurt Mississippi a little bit, but it's good for Wisconsin, we're going to do that. And I'm going to go out there and fight for contracts for our shipbuilders. I was just at Marinette Marine today, touring the shipyard. Russ Feingold refused to fight for the Navy contract that they got there and have a chance to get a lot more. I'm going to fight for those kind of things. I'm going to fight for a fair Medicare formula. I'm going to fight to make sure we get our fair share of the pie so that we're not 49th out of 50th, which is costing us jobs, costing us higher health care benefits, and costing us higher taxes. We need a senator who's going to fight for Wisconsin.
I don't often agree with you, but I agree with the one thing, Bob, and that is we need somebody that understands it. My business, I live it. I've been living the car business. We have import cars. We have domestic vehicles all these years. Right. And you know, 20 years ago, it was Japan. 10 years ago, it was Mexico. Now it's China. I am very, very critical of the fact that we, through our trade negotiators, have got to get this country has got to insist that the other countries honor the World Trade Organization rules, the contracts that were written up. And I think the administration has to do a better job on that. And that's why I believe as a member of the administration, we could do a better job, because certainly Russ Feingold isn't going to get that handled with no business experience. And I think that I really have a good business experience. I'm involved. I'm on the board of the International Auto Dealer Association, which is about free trade, fair and balanced free trade. And I really understand it. I live it. So I really want to take that on. But it starts with holding them accountable to the rules that are drawn up. And if those rules aren't good enough, then we got a problem with our trade negotiations.
We have the big stick. You're right. We have the big stick. And I would use the big stick to open the markets. Not to close markets like Russ Feingold wants to put walls up and let's just talk to ourselves. That would cost Wisconsin people jobs, because we export a lot of stuff here. We'd use our big stick to break down the walls, to get the devaluation fixed in China. I don't want to say it quite this harshly, but we push a button and make them 40% adjust their yuan, their economy would collapse. Now, I'm not suggesting we do that. But we have a lot of clout. We got to use it. We got to use it to open those markets to our goods, and then we'll be competitive with anybody in the world. Our workers will beat anybody given an equal chance.
I'm glad you're finally coming around on that, Bob. So,
I'm going to open the market, not close the market.
I appreciate you talking about fighting for lower taxes here over the past 20 years. But the fact is, Bob, we're still number 49 or 48 or 47. So
yeah, we have a problem.
We got a guy named Jim Doyle who vetoed
the tax freeze.
I want to say something else. I know I'll put my business record up against anybody's at this table. We've created over 1,000 jobs at our construction company in the last 6 years. We have 2,000 employees now. I know the tax cuts work as well, because if we have a couple of dollars left over at the end of the year, if it comes through a tax rebate or a tax cut, we reinvest in our company, buy more backhoes, trenchers, pickup trucks, dump trucks, and that's reinvested in the American economy. Tax cuts do work. I will vote to make the president's tax cuts permanent, because I think if we get more of the people's money in their own pocket, they're going to go out and buy more goods and services, and America will meet that demand by producing more goods and providing more services.
Tim, as you're fond of pointing out, you're always fond of pointing out that 80% of the jobs are created by small businesses.
Yes.
It used to be 71%. Now, that should tell people something. It's now gone from 71% to 80%, and that's because the multinational corporations, they're not creating jobs. They're outsourcing. Small businesses can't move overseas. Big businesses can. So when we start talking about the president's tax cuts and making them permanent, let's make sure that we put a rider in that bill to help out the small business person above all. I was over at a women's incubator business incubator on the north side of Milwaukee. For about $1,500, they can put an entrepreneur in business and they'll employ an average of about 3 to 7 people. That sounds like a pretty good deal. That's one way to eliminate the unemployment here in Wisconsin. For less than the money that Wisconsin's share of what we had sent to Iraq, we could have solved the unemployment problem totally in Wisconsin by creating 80,000 jobs.
There's an issue. You got to have a rising economy. That's what we have right now since President Bush made the tax cuts. And so as a result, we are now down, 4.8% here in Wisconsin and 5.4%, I believe President Bush said the other day when he's here in Wisconsin, is an unemployment rate. No, but we're under 5% here in Wisconsin. So we talk about it in a discussion like this, but in reality, things are getting better. Now, I agree with what was said earlier about that not all of them are the high-paying jobs like they used to be, because there's a change going on. And that's why, as a U.S. Senator, I want to be at the leading edge of creating tax incentives for worker retraining. I live it. Everybody in my business, every single job as a technician, as a salesperson, an office person, managers, it's all changed in just 10 years. And I've been there 38 years. So how many times we've had so many worker retraining incentives and initiatives that were either run by our company or more likely by our franchisors who insist on it. And where you get tax incentives or you get business incentives, or in the case of being a franchisee, you may get a few extra vehicles.
Can you get a tax credit for learning how to sell cars? I'm just curious.
Yeah, you can get them for education. Really? Yeah, it's further education, you bet. But that's what we need.
This is what's important to me because I'm a fourth generation entrepreneur. My dad started a Christmas tree farm when he was 17 years old, jumped off the cliff, said, I'm going to try this. And a lot of people thought he was crazy, but he made it work. My wife and I started a surveying business. We were 23 years old, also jumped off that cliff. We need to encourage that kind of entrepreneurship, that risk-taking, because that's where those 80% of jobs come from, not from somebody, doing it inside a big company. They have to quit their job and sit at that kitchen table with the family and say, we're going to have no income for the next 6 months as we start this business. Can we afford to do this? That's what we need more of. We're dead last in Wisconsin in that. We need to get more of that entrepreneurial spirit. But this country has always led the world in the economy, because we have that entrepreneurial spirit. And I'm afraid it's going away. And that's why I ran for office 20 years ago. That's why I've served in the state legislature. And that's why I'm running for U.S. Senate right now, because that's who I am. You talk about living business. That's who I am. It's guys who jumped off a cliff and said, we're starting this business. And that's what we got to make sure we encourage. And that's why taxes are so important. That's why regulation is more important. A guy sitting at the kitchen table isn't thinking about China, but he's thinking about all those things he's got to fill out and all those things he's got to do before he can even, put the first shovel in the ground to open the office. We've got to make sure that gets streamlined. That's what I've dedicated a lot of my life to for the last 20 years in the legislature.
Well, I think a lot of people are thinking about China in this state. And you're fond of talking about the big multinational corporations. I've been, in a front row seat. We're a family-run business. I've had a front row seat to the corporate corruption that happened at Enron and WorldCom and Global Crossings. Mm-hmm. We used to lay pipe for Enron and cable for Global Crossings and WorldCom. And didn't know it at the time, but now I know we had a front row seat for the corporate corruption that happened there. Revenue swapping, taking on the excessive debt and how they were lying about it. And investors got hurt. Employees got hurt. They lost their jobs. They lost their pensions. We need somebody in Washington, D.C. that'll stand up to these big corporations and will fight for the small business owner and fight for the people so they don't lose their pensions, they don't lose their jobs. I have recent, relevant, real-life experience in this issue. So I think it's important that we can take somebody to Washington, D.C. that has a very strong business background and hasn't just studied or debated or talked about these issues, but he's lived these issues. And there's only 10 small business owners in the U.S. Senate. I think 11 would be a step in the right direction.
I agree.
Well, as a lawyer, I've created hundreds of businesses for other people, whether it was trucking, tool and die companies, high-tech companies, you name it, I probably have incorporated it or put people in business. It takes capital, it takes skill, it takes knowledge. These businesses have created thousands of jobs, not for myself, I didn't profit from it. These other people in the community did. So you need a U.S. Senator that has that broad perspective. But, I was hoping that one of you would at least join my plan, which is to provide 100% tuition tax credits. Right now, if you train somebody, sometimes you get a credit, but sometimes mostly it's just a business deduction. If we really want to be the most competitive country in the world when it comes to future job growth, why not open it up to everybody? Every family, rich or poor, whether it's workers getting retrained or students going to technical school of their choice or college of their choice, Give them every dollar of their tuition
Bob,
back.
That sounds like something that Russ Feingold would bring up, though. I mean, there can't be an entitlement issue. I'm for student credits. There's no question based on how it is. But to go beyond that, my idea is to give tax credits and tax incentives to companies because it ties in with employment. It's an incentive for people to have the job. I live it. I've created thousands of jobs in my career.
It right to the people.
Well, I understand, but it has to be tied in.
The ones that need it more than the big corporations.
But it has to have some kind of accountability with it, like get a job.
Have a job to get a tax credit back.
I got two kids in college. It sounds great, but it'd be very expensive.
All right.
Well, I think it'll pay dividends in the future, Dylan.
For this evening, we're done with jobs as far as this segment goes. It's time to move on then to foreign policy. But before we do, we want to let the candidates kind of take a short break, take a sip of water if there's any left. And
Thank you, Frederica. I'm sorry.
Our crew will be gathering up the questions from the audience at this time. Now, these are audience follow-up questions. We will ask the candidates these questions toward the end of the hour. We'll only be able to ask a few of them, however, but the We the People Media Partnership will also use them to help shape coverage of issues in the days remaining before the primary election and beyond. And now, one of those issues, what do the candidates offer in the way of foreign policy? In particular, what policy to pursue in Iraq? Candidates, once again.
I could still be talking about jobs here, since for 12 years my job was to serve in the Army, and I was an Airborne Ranger Infantry officer. And I think that I have the foundation of understanding to provide leadership in Washington to fight and win this war on terrorism. You know, buddies that I served with in the Army are now in the FBI. They're working for intelligence agencies in Washington, D.C. The point there is that those guys have a foundation to fight this war on terrorism. I have a foundation to fight and win this war on terrorism. But probably more importantly, I have buddies that are over in Iraq and Afghanistan right now. And I get an occasional email from a couple of them. And they're very proud of what they're doing over there. And they believe, and I believe, that what is going on in Iraq right now is a very important part of the equation towards winning this war on terrorism. You know, we haven't had a terrorist attack in this country in 3 years now. Here we are on the eve of 9/11. I don't think anybody thought another 3 years would go by without a terrorist attack in this country. We're doing a lot of the right things. We need to support our troops fully over in Iraq and Afghanistan. We need to give them the tools that they need and the support that they deserve. I think another part of the equation, another reason we haven't had a terrorist attack in 3 years now, is the Patriot Act. And I would love to see all legislation come up for renewal and get tweaked. But I really believe the Patriot Act is going to come up as a yes or no vote. And they're going to force all the senators to make that vote as it is. And I'll vote to renew it. I've been talking about that for over a year now. Now, Russ Feingold, he was the only guy that voted against the Patriot Act. He said, I agreed with 90% of it, classic Russ Feingold, but I'm going to vote against it because of the 10% where I have concerns about civil liberty violations. I'm a veteran. Every veteran, I believe every American, probably everybody at this table, everybody in this room, has concerns about civil liberty violations. The fact is, Dianne Feinstein, Senator from California, she asked the ACLU to give her all the examples of civil liberty violations via the Patriot Act, and they came up with none, zero. There hasn't been any civil liberty violations via the Patriot Act. I think Russ Feingold was wrong in his sole dissenting vote in the Patriot Act. You know, again, here's a leadership issue. Russ Feingold had an opportunity to provide leadership on winning the war on terrorism. He didn't make the right vote. He was wrong. And I will go and I will make the tough decisions in the tough times.
Well, you're exactly right. I tell you what, as I go down the streets in Wisconsin and talk to the people, yes, health care is number one, but it's right alongside of national security because, you know, without a strong national defense, nothing else matters here in our country. We know that we, as Americans, are really at a crossroads here. Our ideals and dreams are on a direct collision course with the realities of terrorism as it is today. And I think we need to look at terrorism in two ways. In other words, I'm so proud of our President Bush for doing what he's doing, but the issue is the other side in the media is looking at it as an Iraq thing, which is part of the answer, of course, because we're there and because we've had the casualties there. But really, it's about the war on terrorism. And the war on terrorism is the key, and the issue is that most of the terrorists have congregated in Iraq. And so we're there. And I couldn't be more proud of our president for the courage, the conviction, the moral fiber that he has, the commitment that he has to steer this country as a leader for our country. And I just tell you, I think that our young military men and women, they're giving up their todays for our tomorrows, and we can never, ever let their losses go in vain. We've got to stay the course. We've got to win. We cannot lose this at all. But along with that, we've got to secure our borders and do everything we can to make sure that we don't have terrorism here on our soil in the United States.
Russ, I agree with you on Bush's preemption doctrine. It's better to fight the terrorists over there than over here. I disagree with all three of you gentlemen on Russ Feingold's vote. I don't think he went far enough. I'm the only attorney running in this race, and I can tell you from my personal experience, the government doesn't always get it right. That doesn't mean the government doesn't have good intentions, that prosecutors don't have good intentions. I have friends and buddies in the FBI. I have a friend that was a Navy pilot who's now teaching at Top Gun. I have clients who I'm doing pro bono work for that are in the 4th Marines over there in Baghdad and Saddam Hussein's city that have their life on the line every day. And I'm going to do everything it takes to protect them and make sure they get the tools they need to do this job. Get in, get the job done, and get out. The United States is not a warmongering country, but we're also a country that is built on liberty and freedom. And these same men and women have given their life over 200 years to make sure that you and I have the liberties that the Patriot Act took away. I would not vote for it as it is. Even Sensenbrenner agrees that the act has to be fixed to restore our civil liberties.
No, it has to have a sunset. Isn't
well, it
that
has
what
a sunset right now, December 31st, 2005.
Oh, I understand that. I do it with a sunset.
And I really shudder personally to think of somebody like Janet Reno after the Elian Gonzalez and Waco and Ruby Ridge and other incidents, if she had these powers. I trust our president with these powers.
But I don't know where you're going. Russ Feingold's going to lose because of the fact that he did this. I believe in my heart that that's going to be a real strong reason why he loses the election. And that's partly because of that, because he's been proven wrong. I mean, we've gone 3 years, as Tim said, 3 years without another attack here. And because of the fact that there hasn't been any violations of civil rights, I'm offended because of the fact that Russ Feingold was putting the civil liberties of a couple hundred suspected terrorists ahead of the rest of the 290 million rest of us. I really think that was terrible, and he's been proven wrong. What's the question?
From a lawyer, I am insulted because he didn't filibuster the act because he read it and he knew it had these flaws.
But see, lawyers are picky, and they're not reality.
That's
why we got to get rid of some of those lawyers. Go down from 59 to 58.
I think we're talking foreign policy, but let me just say this. We're right to talk about the Patriot Act and Homeland Security in context of foreign policy, because the first job of America's foreign policy is to protect us. That's the first job. It's nice to do a lot of good things around the world, but the first job is to protect our citizens. Patriot Act, good. Vote to renew it. Homeland Security, good. Vote to renew it. Russ Feingold voted against both. Now, we focus a lot on Patriot Act because he was the only one, but Homeland Security, he and Tom Daschle and Max Cleland and these other guys voted against it. You know why? Because the unions were against it in Washington, not about their jobs being protected, but about being transferred between agencies. I mean, what an awful reason to vote against something to protect our country. And Russ Feingold is one of those that voted against Homeland Security as well. So that's the first thing our foreign policy should do. The second thing we should do is win the war on terror. That's the foreign policy crisis of the moment. And we are doing that. We are winning the war on terror. Don't let John Kerry confuse you. We are winning the war on terror. We won it in Afghanistan. We won it when we took out Saddam Hussein. We are winning it right now. The battle in Baghdad's a little more drawn out than we'd like, but we didn't decide that. Osama bin Laden decided that. He's the one who sent 12,000 insurgents into the country to disrupt Iraq, because he knows that if we win in Baghdad, if we create a free and democratic Arab nation in the heart of the Middle East, that is the beginning of the end of the war on terror. Because what it does, it's like a virus. It'll spread. People want freedom. I've had a chance to travel around the world quite a bit, doing diplomatic missions, kind of junior diplomacy, let's call it. I was in Japan to do a Japan fellowship. I was in the Soviet Union, actually, as it ended. I was in India and Nepal. I've seen what people in all corners of this world believe. You know what? Take their leaders out of the equation, they believe the same thing we do. They want freedom. They want opportunity. They want what Americans have. Now, we can't give it to everybody, but when Iraq, where it's our national security is at risk, and we have a chance to create an environment where it can create itself, and it will take some time, but it will create itself. And then the war on terror will be won when that young boy, 16-year-old, looks in the mirror and says, I think instead of being a suicide bomber, I'm going to be a computer technician. That's when the war on terror will be over.
But, Bob, we are not an occupying power. Sure, we're still in Germany, we're still in Japan, you know, we're still in North Korea, but that's not the business of the United States to be occupying other parts of the world.
We're not going to be occupying.
How do we get out of there? How do we get out of there quicker?
Every day we're getting
out. Iraq is a country that was artificially created. It was artificially created after World War I by basically the British and the French and the Italians, because they did not want to see a restoration of the Ottoman Empire, which is modern-day Turkey, which sided with Germany. The people in Iraq, they don't get along with themselves. They're like kids fighting in a sandbox. Separate them. Kurdistan's divided in half. Half of it's in Turkey, half of it's in Iraq.
You sound like the guys who said in 1945 Japan would never be a free and pro-Western nation. They are.
I believe in democracy.
They will.
I believe in freedom. Let the people in Iraq vote to have these independent, autonomous countries. Right now what you have is you have these gangster Baathists that are still there jockeying for a position of power to see who's going to take over the whole country when we're gone. And that's going to go on for a long, long time. If we get divided into five separate countries the way they themselves would like to be governed, we could leave a lot quicker.
But freedom and democracy is taking hold in Iraq. And like Bob said, it will spread. And that's what our troops are accomplishing over there. In my 12 years of service, that's what I had hoped to accomplish. I knew I'd never get to defend the United States from the Soviet horde coming across, you know, the continental United States. But if I could liberate the oppressed or spread freedom and democracy, that's what we wanted to do. That's what we're doing right now. We need to continue with this effort. You can come up with 1,000 reasons to not be in Iraq or to get out of there today. But the tough decision, again, leadership, and our president is providing leadership on this issue, is to make that tough decision and see through with what we started. We've turned over Iraq to a sovereign Iraqi government. What was it, June 28th, not too long ago. We're training the security forces. We need to stay the course. In the end, the biggest geopolitical event of our lifetimes, and probably more importantly, our children's lifetimes, will be for democracy to take hold, and it will spread. We can have peace in the Middle East, maybe for the next generation.
The other countries are watching. Libya, Gaddafi already gave up his weapons of mass destruction. Iran is moving toward democracy. I don't know how fast it's going to move. North Korea, not so optimistic about that, but believe me, Kim Il-sung is watching. He is watching to see what we're doing, to see if we have resolve. When Ted Kennedy says we have to have a date certain, or John Kerry says this is our troop withdrawal thing, that is losing our resolve, that is giving a tool to our enemy, and that is not just the enemy in Iraq, but it's people in North Korea and other places around
the
world.
We need more countries to join us. We need a coalition of other countries so we can bring home some of the 130,000 troops that we have over there right now on a gradual basis. I don't believe that we can design what you're saying. That may sound good, you know what I mean, Bob, but the issue is...
We should design it. I think we should let the Iraqi people design
it. Well, they will, but the first things first. We gotta do our job, stay the course, and then we can leave gradually. But we've got to get other countries to come in and join us as a coalition.
Bush is trying to do that, though. Right?
I
mean, you know, you can't force the French to come in. They're not going to come in. And I'm not going to turn things over to the UN and have our troops under the command of some pale blue flag. I mean, they fight for the red, white, and blue and for freedom and for the American dream, and they're not going to be commanded by some other folks. So we're there. We need as many people to help us, but I believe Bush is already doing that. I think more people, as they see us hold our resolve, will join us. The Iraqi people will be more likely to point fingers and say, there's the guy blowing up the neighborhood, once they know why we're there to stay and not, you know, jockeying for position and how quick we can pull out like John Kerry and the Democrats want to do.
We're the only country that's strong enough to provide leadership on winning this war on terrorism, too. And everything we've talked about tonight, from health care to jobs, the economy, it really becomes moot if there's another successful terrorist attack in this country. You know, if we had a biological agent that was unleashed in any community here in America, or a chemical bomb that was detonated in Madison or in Chicago or in Topeka, Kansas, it would bring this country to a screeching halt in a matter of seconds. The visual images that would be on TV would be so traumatic to the American psyche. I just don't think that we would get over it as quickly as we got over 9/11. It is really a very scary scenario to have a biological or chemical or, God forbid, a nuclear weapon get into this country and it be detonated. We have to have somebody in Washington, D.C., I think President Bush is doing this, providing leadership, and he needs more senators that are there with him, helping him provide leadership to fight and win this war on terrorism. It's such a big issue.
I agree with you. That's why I'm running. I'd like to be there and be the guy to be the ally to help do it, because, like I said earlier, without a strong national defense and preventing terrorism coming on our soil again, nothing else matters. I mean, that is the key thing to our whole survival and for our children and our grandchildren, so that they can have they can live in peace like we have and have the opportunities that we've had here in the United States. I mean, that is the key.
One of the things for us we have not discussed is why we are in this situation now. You know, you look at the whole Clinton administration. They dismantled half of our bases. You know, they basically traded with the enemy. I mean, the Laurel technology went right into the hands of the communist Chinese, over to the North Koreans. They put it with Scud missiles. They were selling Scud missiles to Saddam Hussein. They'll sell Scud missiles to anybody that can pay the price. You know, we got to get a handle on where we went wrong during the Clinton administration years and rebuild our military and rebuild our American preparedness. But we also have to treat our men and women in uniform a lot better and our veterans. We haven't talked tonight about revamping and modernizing the Veterans Administration. You know, if I was a young person, I was thinking going into the military, one thing I might be thinking is, how am I going to be treated when I'm out? You know, here you have veterans who are still, in this day and age, they have to drive 200, 300 miles to their closest VA hospital, which do a great job. And there are a lot of new satellite VA clinics around, but why not just let them have their VA card and get into any hospital in the United States and get the treatment they need?
Let's do it by state. They do have that now, satellite clinics around the state. I've gone into that. I was just over at the VA in Milwaukee last week. Got quite a tour, quite a presentation about it. And I was really, really pleased with the reports that I was hearing from the people that are actually heading it up. Surely they'd give me a bias because they're heading it up. But my reason was I was asking a lot of questions as a skeptic. Okay, and I got some really good answers. And I talked to veterans. I had some veterans with me when we were there at the meeting, and I met other veterans there. I talked specifically to some of the people who were in there in wheelchairs and talked about their treatment, and some of them who had gone to some of the other satellite clinics. So, I mean, I was really impressed with the fact that here in Wisconsin, they're doing a really good job.
We've had the number one state in the union as far as having a strong support for our veterans in this country, led by a strong bipartisan effort. Terry Musser, who heads up the Veterans Committee in the Assembly, has been the leader in the state on that. He's heading up my Veterans for Welch, by the way. We've worked together on a lot of issues to make sure veterans do get taken care of, because it is part of the national defense issue. If you're not able to prove to folks that you're going to be taken care of and get the benefits you deserve, not that you want, but that you deserve, we're not going to have the force we need in the future. And other states aren't doing that. And the national government has let down a lot of veterans. And we need a senator to go out there.
The body armor bill, to give the men and women their flak jackets and the tools they need. That's the kind of president we need to keep 4 years from now.
That concludes our candidate conversation, but we're moving along now to our questions from the audience. They've been listening carefully, and we have a selection of them, a question for each of you. But we would like to point out that we want each candidate to answer the question by stating his own position on these subjects, not the other guys. So speaking for yourself, in roughly 30 seconds to a minute, our first question goes to Russ Darrow, and it says that many people in the audience, including Kumud Gupta and Lindsay Weiss, ask you, how would a person living hand-to-mouth put any significant amount of money in a health savings account?
In a health savings account, first of all, if they have a job, the idea is to have the money come by way of a tax incentive from the government out of their pay. In other words, just like today where you have health insurance or you have Social Security, so on. So some of the money is tax-free. It goes into that account. It builds up there. You know it's yours. It stays with you. That's a guarantee. Now, you're going to have four or five or six choices of investment vehicles so that you could do it just like you do in a 401k and where it's offered so that you could take a conservative approach or a middle aggressive or maybe a more aggressive and buy some stocks in the stock market, the equity market. And that would go up. But the point is you own it. If you change jobs, it stays with you. If you go between states, if you move, it stays with you. And you own it. And then at the end of the day, when you get older and if you haven't spent it all, it's yours, you own it, you just would pay a tax on it and take it out. But that's the issue. Now, I think that maybe you'd have a little higher deductibles on some of the medicine over time as years change, but that'd be dealt with, as you know, on any kind of a legislative issue like this that affects everybody. First of all, it has to be reasonably pleasing to the people that are involved in it. And secondly, it provides more choice. And the whole idea of a Republican is to give more choice and more options and more competition. That's what Republicans want, and that's what I want.
Okay.
Can I jump in?
Nope. I'm told to move it along, but the next question does go to you.
Right.
And it is from Mark Burwell, who asks, what can we do to shift from manufacturing, which is declining, to building infrastructure based on technology?
Well, it's going to take some time, and it might take 10 years or 20 years before we become more of a technological-based economy here in Wisconsin. But if you're sitting at home right now and you're unemployed because your manufacturing job, your tool and die job went over to China or India, you can't wait that long, 10 or 20 years. We need to do something now, and I'll go back to what we were talking about, stopping countries like China from cheating. But if we can have more incentives for people to retrain and maybe be able to move from a tool and die maker to a computer technician, then I'm all for having that kind of incentive in the marketplace so that we can evolve as an economy. But it's hard to force an economy to evolve. You can certainly, and the job of a senator is to give incentives for an economy to evolve. But I don't think you want to say, we're going to stop being a manufacturing economy today and we're going to become a technological-based economy tomorrow.
Okay. The next question goes to Bob Welch from a Mike Goodman somewhere here in the audience. He asks, can the private sector be relied upon to ensure the higher risk categories of people at affordable prices?
Actually, you know what that means. We in Wisconsin have a risk sharing pool called HRSP, which we've set up for those high risk cases. It's not cheap. If you can afford to pay something, you pay something. If you can't afford to pay something, it is cheap. It is free. And that is a model that is mostly funded by the health insurance companies. They kick in. Any insurance company that sells insurance in the state has to kick in. It doesn't come from general tax dollars. It comes from those premiums that we put onto those health insurance. So we all kind of pay for that high-risk pool. So if someone is, you know, self-employed and has diabetes, they can't possibly get insurance. They're just not going to get it. And there's no model that I have or that anybody else has that's going to provide that other than through some government assistance. And I would just add that on health savings account, it isn't the government that puts in the money. It's the employer or the employee themselves, some mix depending on what the employer is going to offer. Or self-employed, you can do it yourself, but it is pre-tax.
And I wanted to say it's not a blanket program for everybody, but it will introduce more competition into the medical marketplace. So that will bring the cost down and efficiency up.
Yes. And that's what you wanted to say
that's
after he was speaking.
To
you
and
got
I had
it.
A way to turn
all right.
What I wanted to say to Tim is it's all about worker retraining incentives. We need worker retraining.
Okay. All right, that's good. I like how you guys are doing that. But the next question goes to Robert Gerald Lorch. It is from a Kristen Schenborn, who asks, you speak of tax cuts, but what about the budget deficit?
The budget deficit, let's face it, Washington, D.C. spends way too much money on pork barrel projects. They built a jungle in Iowa as part of a pork barrel project for one of the congressmen over there. This stuff has to end. Now, there's one easy way to get cut to the chase and not play political footballs with balancing or cutting the budget, and that's just putting a 10% across-the-board cut on every agency in Washington, D.C., except for Social Security and the military, but not on program benefits, on bureaucrat salaries for a change. You know, every corporation in America has had to become more efficient and economize and downsize, except the federal government. The growth there has just continued unabated for years and years and years. Let's just make them do a 10% cut. Whether they fire 10% of the bureaucrats there or cut salaries 10%, I'm sure we can trust the agency heads, if they had that power, to find the savings. And that 10% savings could go to pay for a lot of the things that the United States needs, or at least create a tax cut. And I'm sure that people back home could put that to use in the economy.
Frederick, go ahead.
You want a little help on that one?
You know what? Not really. I was going to ask him something else. I was going to ask him just a quick follow-up to your tax, full 100% tax credits for education. Where does that money come from?
That would come from, well, it'd come from two places, such as tax cutting, like I just proposed, but also it would pay for itself, because you have to realize, when people have a higher degree, whether it's college or technical school, they're going to be in a higher income tax bracket. This is a partnership with the government, not a handout, but a hand up. And when they're earning more because they're in a higher skilled job or higher education, the real winner is really the IRS, as well as the United States of America, because we're going to be more competitive. And this is the thing that's going to grow the economy and bring in more revenue as well to the government in the long term.
I'm being told we got to go. So thanks very much to all of you. That is our candidate forum for tonight. We do again want to thank the candidates, Robert Gerald Lorch, Bob Welch, Russ Darrow, and Tim Michaels. Highlights and analysis of tonight's debate on WISC-TV tonight at 10, over the weekend on Wisconsin Public Radio, and in the Wisconsin State Journal, our media partners in the We the People Project, and on a special edition of Here and Now, which begins in just a minute on Wisconsin Public Television. Don't forget, next Tuesday is Election Day. I'm Frederica Freiberg. Good night.
We the People, Wisconsin U.S. Senate Republican Primary Candidate Forum, was made possible in part by the Wisconsin Education Association Council, working to make every school a great school so that every child leaves school prepared for life and the jobs of the future. Great schools benefit you. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Wisconsin, Wisconsin's health care partner. American Family Insurance, all your protection under one roof. Madison Gas and Electric Company, working to meet the growing needs of our community through a mix of resources while helping customers protect the environment through conservation.
I'm Frederica Freiberg, having just come over from the other side of the studio from tonight's debate. Welcome to a special edition of Here and Now. I'm getting some post-debate help here tonight from WISC-TV's Neil Heinen.
Hi,
thanks, Fred, for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. And what an interesting night it's been. You may be able to hear in the background, people are still making their way from our studios.
That's right, audience members who watched our U.S. Senate primary candidate forum. We have debate analysis later in the program, and we will meet a trio of high schoolers who will vote for the first time this fall.
Also tonight, a short course on primary elections. Who can vote next Tuesday? For which parties? The director of the State Elections Board is here for that.
But first, we dial right back into the race for U.S. Senate. As you know, debates like tonight's are not the only political speech on the airwaves. There are also those ever-present political commercials.
Our reality check series helps fact-check claims candidates are making in those Senate ads. And tonight, WISC-TV's Colin Benedict sorts through the claims incumbent Russ Feingold makes in his Patriot Act ad.
So far in this campaign, you've been hearing a lot about one vote Senator Russ Feingold took. Here it is, House Resolution 3162. 98 senators voted for it. Senator Feingold was the only one to vote against it. And everyone is using TV ads to tell you about it.
How many wrong choices can Russ Feingold make for Wisconsin? He voted against the Patriot Act.
One senator voted against this. Russ Feingold.
That's why I opposed the USA Patriot Act.
Let's start with an ad from Tim Michaels that deals with one specific part of the Patriot Act.
Before 9/11, the government couldn't use roving wiretaps on terrorists. They could only wiretap a specific phone. The Patriot Act gave law enforcement the right to wiretap the terrorists, no matter how many phones they have.
Let's stop it there. This needs clarification. A wiretap applies only to one phone number. A roving wiretap applies to a person. The government can listen in on conversations even if that person uses different phones.
But before the Patriot Act, the government could use roving wiretaps. Department of Justice documents show they're used for drug offenses and racketeering, and even for terrorists and criminal offenses. The difference now is they're used in national security investigations.
If Senator Feingold would have had his way, we would not have the Patriot Act in place. We would not be able to have roving wiretaps. The terrorists would really be at an advantage that they're not at now.
Russ Feingold did vote against the Patriot Act, which included this part of it. But he says he supports roving wiretaps.
Yes, the government needs to be able to do a roving wiretap on a terrorist, but we got to make sure they're going after a terrorist, not a completely innocent person in Middleton.
In fact, Feingold says he supports 90% of what's in the Patriot Act. It's the other 10% he finds unacceptable. And you've heard about that in his responding TV ad.
But certain provisions gave the government extreme powers to obtain library records and monitor computers of ordinary citizens with no ties to terrorists.
First, let's examine the first half of that sentence about obtaining library records and monitoring computers.
The senator is referring to Section 215 of the Patriot Act. It gives the government the authority to check things like library records. If it tells a judge it's to protect against international terrorism or clandestine intelligence activities, the judge must allow the search. Section 217 creates so-called computer trespassers and allows the government to search in certain circumstances.
Feingold clearly identifies two new search areas for federal investigators. But the second half of the sentence makes the statement ambiguous. Listen again.
Obtain library records and monitor computers of ordinary citizens with no ties to terrorists.
Senator Feingold can't definitively show that anyone's civil liberties have been violated or that anyone with no terrorist ties is being tracked. However, it could be happening, and here's why.
Further down in Section 215, under subsection D, it says, no person shall disclose to any other person that the Federal Bureau of Investigation has sought or obtained tangible things under this section. In other words, if the FBI asked for library records of, say, a Madison resident, the library director here couldn't tell us if the FBI did. We know because we asked her.
Has the FBI ever asked you for someone's library records?
I couldn't tell you if they had.
Let's move on to Feingold's final claim. It says there's support for changing the Patriot Act.
After closer study, senators from both parties agree the Patriot Act must be fixed.
This is true. A bill to change the Patriot Act, called the SAFE Act, is in Congress.
We checked its support. 20 senators have signed on. 14 are Democrats, 5 Republicans, and an independent. Part of it would require more government proof before using roving wiretaps and would place new limits on library searches.
That bill has not passed and won't be dealt with until after the election. With this reality check, I'm Colin Benedict.
And Jen Ertl is the Reality Check series researcher. We move back over to the Republican side of the Senate race now. As many of you know, the candidates running in the Republican primary for U.S. Senate debated in our studios tonight. Some who attended that special broadcast are still making their way out of our studios. Here's Neil Heinen with two of those audience members and their thoughts about what they heard and learned during tonight's forum. Neil?
Thanks, Fred. Yeah, that's right. We persuaded two audience members from our candidates forum to stay after school tonight and share what they think. Mark Burwell is a businessman who came down to the debate from Green Bay. And Sandy Seiler is a dairy producer from Mozanie. Thank you very much for doing this tonight. Mark, let me start with you and just ask you, how did what you heard tonight from these candidates compare with your impressions of them coming in?
Well, I think it kind of probably narrowed it to four candidates down to two. I thought those two candidates that came out real good. But I think it really was broke down into three elements on the issues. And I think I pretty much graded each one accordingly. I think on the health care issue, I think it was probably a D minus. I think the candidates need to go back and really do some more research on that. Probably the strongest was really the job development. I thought they were great on that, which makes me feel good because I think that's a strength that we need to really look at. And then as far as foreign policy, that's probably an average I would have given them because I think there's a lot of political footballness in that.
So what you're saying, Mark, is how they did on those three topics is how you narrowed the field from 4-2.
Exactly.
What were your impressions, Sandy?
Okay, well, regarding the health care issue that you mentioned, I think the D minus was a good way to put that. Coming from agriculture, I realized the real difficulty of trying to find affordable, accessible health care for people in whether it's dairy farming or other small businesses. And when I heard proposals of these the personal health care accounts, well, that's really pretty difficult for people that are just barely making ends meet. So I was disappointed in what I heard from the candidates regarding their approach toward answering the health care challenge for Wisconsin citizens.
Did you get information tonight that helped you make your choice, that helped you narrow the field?
Okay. Well, I was interested in what the candidates had to say. I have already made my decision, yes, but I did want to hear how the candidates stacked up on the issues, conversing with one another.
I thought the candidates did a pretty good job sticking to the issues. Obviously,
yes.
There was a little more passion over some than others, and the Patriot Act was one where there was a great deal of interest, I thought. How important is the Patriot Act to you, though, Sandy, as an issue compared to the other issues that you've mentioned?
Well, hearing what the candidates had to say, three of them, the response does cause concern for me because I do believe that part of protecting our security, it should also be a part of protecting our freedoms and our way of life. And I heard several references in a very negative way about the way that Senator Feingold voted on that particular piece of legislation. One of the candidates did agree with that vote, and I applaud him for that because I think that our freedoms and our way of life are in the direction that our country is going with diplomatic issues are a real concern to a lot of citizens in the
so
state.
So that issue clearly resonated with you. Did it with you, Mark?
Well, I think I look at it kind of in between. I'm not trying to sit on the fence, Neil, but I think because we're in a technology and so close-knit worldwide that I think the Patriot Act did one thing that I was very satisfied with, and that was it made a wake-up call. A wake-up call on what can really happen. So it's kind of like a stop sign. Now, the sunsetting, of course, of that bill is probably real important. So, again, that's why I've always felt with it, and I didn't think anything changed tonight on their views.
Now, when you talked about the issues that were important to you, you did not mention tax cuts. There was quite a bit of time spent on tax cuts. Yes. Where does that fit in?
I think that's the misconception of people in the state of Wisconsin, especially in the small business sector. I think that we tend to think that tax cuts, business credits, inheritance tax, things like that are important. Used to be in the 80s and the 90s. I think the most important thing for people in the state of Wisconsin is education, is basic issues, because small business people are so in the trenches. They're worried about those type of issues that are hardcore, basic grassroots issues, not necessarily things that relate to the business, especially in Wisconsin, because we're here for basically a lot of quality of life.
That's the businessman perspective, Sandy. From the perspective of a dairy producer, is tax cuts, are they important to you?
Well, as you know, a dairy producer is also a business person.
Right.
And I would agree with a lot of your statements. When we talk about Wisconsin being a high tax state, well, what are we getting for our taxes? We also have become very accustomed to having good roads and good schools and a lot of services that do come with a price tag, and we can't have all these wonderful services and infrastructure with, there's a price for that, and I think that that line gets blurred and how that happens. So I'm more concerned about how we will continue to provide quality education and health care and infrastructure and developing jobs. And you can't do that by just slashing taxes.
Well, now, you've said, Sandy, that both in health care and in taxes, none of the candidates really spoke to you on those issues. Let me ask you about prescription drug prices.
Mm-hmm.
Is that relevant in your life, the way that these candidates laid out their prescription drug plans?
Well, the prescription drug issue, I relate that more to as part of the health care costs. And looking at some of the information several months ago, I wanted to know how many insurance companies did business in the state of Wisconsin. And when I called the office of the Commissioner of Insurance, I was told that there, as of 2002, there were over 1,500 companies, licensed insurance companies, to do business in the state of Wisconsin. Well, that tells me there's a lot of profit there. What I would have rather heard from the candidates, how they would direct the profits and administrative costs from the insurance industry into programs and making health care accessible, affordable, and adequate for every Wisconsin citizen. I didn't hear that tonight.
Mark, as much as you've seen the ads that the candidates have run and perhaps read accounts in the newspaper, and you compare that with what you saw and heard tonight, do you think you know who these four candidates are? Do you think citizens of the state know who these four candidates are if they saw this tonight?
I think that's why We the People, the forum, was very important for me as an individual, and hopefully other people are going to see the program, because I think it did actually have the cream come to the top. And I knew all the candidates, but when the issues are there and you get to see that, I think, like I said, the cream comes to the top.
Now, you came in with your candidate already chose. You didn't. Your mind wasn't changed tonight. Is that right?
No.
And is it because what because you thought your candidate did particularly well?
Well, I know when I was asked to participate in this, I was asked on which candidate I would be supporting, and that I am a supporter of Senator Feingold. So I did come in here with, again, trying to learn more about all of the issues, but also to find out how the candidate that eventually face the senator stacks up on those issues.
Sandy Seeler and Mark Burwell, thank you very much for participating tonight. Thanks for spending a few minutes with us.
I
appreciate it.
There were some other people in tonight's debate audience who were watching carefully, sorting through positions and issues as folks who will vote this fall for the very first time. They join us now not to handicap the debate, but to talk about what's happening in campaigns that is catching their attention. They are all Edgewood High School seniors, Edgewood High here in Madison. They are Kristen Shenborn, Andrew Brenton, and Brian Williams. And thanks very much for being here. You could be doing something else a little more fun maybe on a Friday night, huh?
Perhaps.
Well, now, you have obviously never voted before. You're all just 18, is that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And are you looking forward to the opportunity to go to the polls?
Sure, yeah. It should be great.
Do most people your age, though, I mean, are they spending more time thinking about, you know, the upcoming football season or, you know, getting into college than Tuesday's primary election?
I think initially, yes. However, when there are issues such as the war on terror now, with the draft and jobs and education, that all are going to affect all 18-year-olds and those college students also, I think it becomes a big issue. And even though, you know, today's football game or tomorrow's soccer game or the test tomorrow may be a little bit more important in the front of our minds, I think the issue of election is really in the back of our minds. It's still there.
Andrew and Brian, do you feel the same way, that your peers are actually kind of focusing on this?
More of the kids that I've sort of been associating with who are able to vote have felt that this year's voting term is very important due to the fact that there are a lot of issues that we need to address, such as jobs and education, which most kids our age, which is very important to us. So.
Andrew, too, also, we've talked about some of these issues, but terror, this is something that is new to this election. And when you were freshman in high school, this wasn't even out there. That's accurate, four years ago? And
right.
So is this front of mind, or just what are the most salient issues?
Well, for me, I guess taxes and the size of government, actually. Social Security, the baby boomers are kind of going to deplete that, and then we're kind of going to get left with the bill.
So our you're generation. Already thinking 60 years out or, or 50 years out
right.
To Social Security. But taxes, in what way? That they're too high?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Much too high.
And spending in
right.
Washington,
yeah.
The deficit. And so you're thinking that people are spending your future.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about terror, Brian? Is this something that it's a whole new world for young people moving into it?
I feel that what happened for 9/11, many teens are responding to this upcoming election because either they're against terror or they're not, and they feel that if they do not get their voice out to be heard, nothing will be done, and that's why they're voting.
Is it scary to think that also, given that we are engaged with Iraq, that you could be called up?
Yes.
I'm very much worried about it. I have a number of guy friends who are 18 and who are thinking of joining the draft because they want to serve the country, and the fact of them going away for now that the drafts have been extended, the time period over there for who knows how long, is really scary because it's my generation and people who are dying, and it's, you know, me from the future looking for even marriage, even though it's way for it's a long distance out. You know, there's going to be limited resources and limited people because of it's our age group that's getting killed there.
Do you feel as though your involvement in the issues is being taken for granted, or your vote?
I think youth are very much overlooked because I think that youth are, as you said before, too involved and too much thinking about the next football game or the test, and that youth don't care, but I think that's a big misconception. I think a lot of youth, even with the war on terror now and education issues, are a lot more involved than they were in the past.
Do you think that people are reaching out to you? Do you feel like some of the messages have been directed toward you?
Yeah, we actually had a speaker in our politics class come and talk to us from the youth vote personnel, yes.
And that person's message was that you could actually count?
Yeah.
There's many campaigns out there and ads that are reaching out to teenagers. There's a thing on MTV that they're having to get more teens that are 18 to vote.
And have you seen that?
I've not seen it personally yet. But
Well, where do most people your age, if we can generalize this way, get their political news and election news and issue-oriented type news?
Pop culture, I guess, MTV.
School and MTV.
It seems to be very popular now to vote, I guess, because MTV and Smack Your Vote, I guess, from a wrestling federation.
Do you think that is it split, just as Wisconsin is kind of a battleground state, do you think the youth vote in Wisconsin or among your peers is split that way?
Well, I guess it is kind of split, but the youth seem to be kind of more liberal, I'd guess, you know, kind of radical. I kind of pick that up. If you walk down State Street, you know?
Well, sure.
Well, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Is that your sense, too,
yeah,
that more younger people tend to, at least in this presidential election, be tending toward a change?
Yes.
As opposed to the status quo? But
yeah,
that's not where you're at, right?
Well, I mean, I guess not. I mean, economy, I guess I'd like to, you know, keep the taxes down, but some of the social issues, I guess, I'd be more liberal on, like, you know, the whole gay marriage and abortion thing.
Well, that's kind of hard, then. Where
right.
do you go?
Well, I mean, yeah, I'm not really a, you know, Republican per se. I guess I kind of go with them on the economic mm-hmm. and, mm-hmm. You know, the libertarians, kind of mm-hmm. the social aspect of that.
Mm-hmm. So it's more of an independent kind of
yeah,
position.
I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, so you all will be going to the polls for the first time on Tuesday.
Yes.
And have you ever been into a polling place before?
I have.
Mm-hmm. Well, like with your mom or dad,
yeah,
or something?
Yeah, like a little child walking in.
Yeah. Does it seem frightening at all to you to go in there for the first time, know what to do?
I'm kind of just excited to go. You actually get to have your voice heard and pick someone for Congress or Senator, so...
And
yeah.
and what about you? I mean, I remember going the first time and thinking, I have no idea what I'm supposed to do here. But
right. Yeah, I'm not actually going to be voting until the candidate is picked. So, I mean, I'll vote in the
general.
The Feingold versus whoever wins
uh-huh.
and the president. But I won't be 18 until October 10th.
Okay.
So,
all right.
I won't be able to vote on it.
Well, it'll be great to be able to do that. Many people don't do it, and it's great that you're going to take the opportunity. And we very much appreciate the opportunity to talk to you tonight, too.
Well, thank you.
So thanks very much.
As most of you know, next Tuesday is primary election day, but do you know how a primary works in Wisconsin?
Well, it is not as straightforward as the general election, so we invited State Elections Board Executive Director Kevin Kennedy to come by tonight with a few pointers. Well, this is great to have the expert here on polling.
And I have, Kevin, a ballot, an official ballot other than the word sample written across it. For the viewers at home who can't see this quite so clearly, this is the ballot that will show up in the paper on Monday morning. Now, is this a standard ballot? Is this what you see in every polling place in the state?
Pretty much a standard ballot. 85% of the ballots in Wisconsin are counted using the technology that this has done. Now, some of them, instead of having an arrow on them, have a little oval to fill in, but the idea is that it's counted electronically. It's a paper ballot that's marked, but we count it electronically. Most of the voters will use that. We have about 10% of the voters will choose among paper ballots, and just a very small number still using the lever machines.
All right. No chance of hanging chads in Wisconsin?
No, we haven't had punch cards since 2000.
Now, Wisconsin has an open primary. What's open about it?
Well, what's open about it is there's no barrier to your choice in selecting this, which primary you want to participate in. In most states where they have a closed primary, what you do is when you register to vote, you register as a Republican, a Democrat, a Libertarian, or unaffiliated. You make a choice as part of your registration. It's very public. And we don't put that barrier on so that on Election Day, if the Republican primary is what attracts you, you go pick the candidates for that party. If it's the Democratic primary, you're still limited to one party, but there's no barrier in advance on that. Or in some states, you have to actually sign what we call a disaffiliation. So we have no public record in Wisconsin of who's a Republican, who's a Democrat.
I just want to ask one follow-up to that, and that is, if you go to the polling place, though, on Tuesday, and you mark that you want to vote Republican or Democrat, say it's Republican, but then you actually also mark a Democrat candidate, the whole thing gets thrown out.
It can. In fact, but we did design a fail-safe. We know that voters get frustrated by this because, you know, you saw the debate earlier tonight. People are very interested. They might want to make a choice on that, but there's also some Democratic primaries throughout the state, and you have to make a choice one way or the other. When they see this ballot, they see all of them in front of them. So when we design the ballot, we have you make your choice first, which party you're going to be in. And then if human nature takes over and you decide you're going to move to another section, it will only count the party that you picked. If you don't make a choice first off among the parties you're going to participate in, and you cross over, the ballot will come back to you at the polling place. The machines are programmed, and you'll get another chance.
Kevin, there's always such an emphasis put on registering to vote. There are get-out-the-vote drives constantly, and yet registering to vote is still quite easy in the state of Wisconsin.
It's easy in Wisconsin. It's actually easy in most parts of the country, but registering to vote is part of the political process in terms of identifying people who are going to participate. So we see a lot of voter registration drives going on right now, and particularly now because Wisconsin's a battleground state.
And you can still register at the polls.
You can register at the polls, and that's actually been very beneficial for Wisconsin because it makes it easier for us to comply with certain other requirements that have been forced upon us by the federal government that are actually going to make things easier in the long run for us.
And so again, we should just reiterate, and then I know you have another question that you want to ask, but that you can go to the polls without signing up with anybody on the street and register and vote day of.
You can register at the polling place. You have to bring proof of residence, something that shows you live at the location you want to vote from.
We need a quick answer for this, Kevin, but every year, and particularly in an election like this, which will be a high turnout election, people get to the polls 15 minutes before the polls close. There's a long line. Do they get in line, or is it too late? When do you?
Once you're in line, you get to vote.
Okay.
When 8 o'clock comes around, the poll worker goes to the end of the line so that anyone who comes after 8 can't do it. We've had people have to wait in line for an hour. We do encourage you to get there early. Get there in the middle of the day. It's hard to schedule, but do it.
Kevin All Kennedy, right. Thanks a lot.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You. And we remind people to vote on Tuesday. That's our program for tonight.
If you missed our We the People Republican primary debate broadcast live earlier this evening, you can see it at 9 o'clock tonight on UPN 14 here in Madison. And the state public TV network will re-air the forum Sunday morning at 10.
And thank you, Neil, for your help tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Nice to see you. That's our program. I'm Frederica Freiberg. Have a great weekend.